1210 on the Noon Business Lunch on WGN Radio. John Williams here with Craig Bolanos, the founder and wealth advisor at VestGen Wealth Partners. Click on GetRetiredStayRetired.com. That's how you reach him, and we've reached out today. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you and your audience as always. Lots of happenings in the market, economy, politics, and the world order these days, John.
Yeah, really. Where do you want to start? Maybe the markets, which don't seem to be that interested in some of these other events. What's going on there?
No, I think the market has broadly looked past this incredible wall of worry. And boy, what a euphemism. The market tends to climb a wall of worry because there's been so much. John, we've seen oil go from 67 to 112. We started June at 96. We're in the low 70s. You've got a new Fed chair, but the beat keeps on marching because productivity enhancements are real. Artificial intelligence, infrastructure, and investing is real and ongoing. And best of all, earnings per share have grown double digits so far in 2026.
Is all of that because of AI and data centers? Is that what's doing this?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a part of the narrative. It's a part of the story. And I know so many people are surprised with all the ongoing chaos that the overall market looks rather calm. But another part of the story, John, is it's not about the Mag 7, the Magnificent 7, those names that have carried this market for years. Some of them have come under tougher times. We're seeing this market broad, and you and I talked 2 weeks ago about the revenge of the old economy, the industrial stocks, the material stocks, the energy stocks that are doing well. And as a result of this, this market's creating a firmer base for its advancement while the economy continues to be more narrow, courtesy of that K-shaped economy.
Yeah, so the K-shape is still there. And you haven't said anything that is different from what I've heard from other experts on this show, but it does worry me. It didn't worry me, but one can't help but note that so much of this is pegged to the artificial intelligence boom and the building of these data centers and then everything that stretches out from that. And I guess there's no chance this can be a bubble, right, Craig? Because it's just too entrenched that there's no reason to worry that we have too many eggs in one basket here?
We can always look and we can always worry and we can pay attention to those parallels and signs from the 1990s. But what's undeniable to me is how the investment in technology over the last 2.5 to 3 years by non-technology companies has created productivity per unit labor hour of work, which is driving earnings per share in these sectors I just mentioned, the industrial sector, the energy sector, the material sector, the financial sector. So it's not just a one-trick pony of technology stocks leading us higher, courtesy of AI. The efficacy of that technology is broadening, and we've seen changes like this before in economies as we've revolutionized. I think that's where we're at here, so it does look to be durable and sustainable, but always buyer beware. Stocks, you know, just like trees, they can't grow to the sky forever, but we're not yet touching the sky.
Yeah, okay. Are there any areas outside of that sector? You know, I could see how electrical companies, utilities, manufacturing or construction would benefit from the AI boom. Are there any other areas that might not be so obvious but are also poised, you think, Craig, to do well?
Well, I mean, look at what's happening this week. You know, you've got 8 of the 11 sectors in the S&P that are green for the week. Industrials, like you just mentioned, and healthcare. Look at healthcare now hitting all-time highs over this recent period of time. Now, we're not seeing money hang out yet in consumer staples, utilities, telecoms, or REITs. Those have all been hit hard for the spring. And what that tells me is if money was in those sectors, that investors would be preparing for the worst. They're not. Investors are still positioning for where the growth is and be on the lookout for healthcare as one additional winner coming from this technological advancement. It's probably not just a winner for the stocks, John. I think it could be a winner for all of us in terms of diagnostics, better efficacy, Don't even get me started, but it could be great.
The president did not sign that housing assistance bill, but the 10th day lapses at midnight tonight. So without the president's signature, it still becomes law, even though he said he wouldn't sign it unless Congress enacted the SAVE Act. They haven't, but it'll still become law because he hasn't vetoed it. At least he hasn't yet. If that then does become law, and those efforts to lower some costs and increase inventory on the market come to bear, do you see much change in the market or in the housing market as a result, or is that a much slower churn? We're not going to see anything in the near term.
Well, it reminds me of the price of oil, John. It rises like a bottle rocket on the 4th of July, but the price of oil tends to float down like a feather, doesn't it, when it comes to the pump?
Yeah.
And I'm very encouraged of, let me say this again, the massive bipartisan support that is here for this bill on housing. I think it's directionally correct, because anytime you can eliminate, reduce some of the red tape, some of the bureaucracy, it's about speed to implementation. It is going to increase inventory, but it's not going to dramatically change anything overnight. I think investors are still wringing their hands over interest rates, the cost to borrow on a 30-year mortgage higher than people want. But at least this is acknowledgement that we needed improvement in housing. It's Congress doing what they're supposed to do. See, John, they actually do work. Look, bipartisan legislation. So I'm encouraged. The president, did he say no thank you? Yeah, he said no thank you. But on his Truth Social Pulse, he said it was just in protest because he didn't get the Save America Act. Well, you know what? So be it. Government still works. Checks and balances still work.
We're talking to Craig Bolanos. We'll continue this conversation. I wanted to ask you about the disconnect between refining prices and gas prices, a little bit more about interest rates and the market with Craig Bolanos on the Noon Business Lunch. Craig Bolanos is on the line. We're talking a little bit about the markets. Craig is the founder and wealth advisor at VestGen Wealth Partners. Click on GetRetiredStayRetired.com. That's his website. What's this business, Craig, about the difference between the refining process and the price at the pump? What's that all about?
Well, it frustrates me because I just had to put high test into one of my vehicles last night. That's the 93 octane, John. Crude oil is only part of the equation. The real issue right now is refining. You got to refine that crude oil into the gasoline that we consume, the diesel we consume, and the refineries, they're earning record profit margins because the demand for gasoline, diesel, jet fuel remains so strong because the U.S. economy is resilient. So when refining capacity is tight, even if the price of crude oil falls, it's not translating into the cheaper gasoline quick enough in the way we as consumers all would expect.
I think when we see that, we just go, oh, that's just the oil companies, you know, taking the profit when they can. Oil companies do own the refineries, though, but you make it sound like it's a little bit out of their hands. It's just the supply is greater than their ability to process. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it is supply and demand combined with natural free market economics, which is they don't want to give up their record profit margins. So I'm not going to call it gouging, but they're definitely creating value for shareholders, but it's hurting some of the citizens. So it's a mixture of both, John.
What do you have to say about the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, so far?
You know what? He's taken such a hard, innovative, and different look at how the Fed is communicating to any and all investors. I mean, this is going to have an impact. I mean, if we think about the fact that he's pushing towards the removal of interest rate forecasts, removing forward guidance, it's going to fundamentally change how equity stocks and fixed income bonds are valued. I think this is going to mean stocks are going to experience some more frequent swings because we're not going to have the Fed hints. The Fed is going to be more quiet. The Fed is going to be more humble. They're not going to be as transparent. It's going to cause all of us not to rely on the Fed, but to rely on the data. And I think the bond market impact is the same. So what do I say to this? I say the following. I'm giving him a good grade. He appears to be a good student. I'm encouraged by his acknowledgement that there's a need for the Fed to change. just as our economy is changing. That goes back to the technology. And you know what? If you don't consistently innovate, you can't make progress. This is just one more example of a Fed that is committed to being data-driven. They're going to create progress. They're just changing the way they communicate with us. It's like I'm back to the 1990s wondering how big Alan Greenspan's portfolio was when he walked up and down those steps. I don't know if you remember those days, John, but that's what we used to do.
Yeah, no. Well, it's interesting to me that all of the drama around the Fed and the White House is gone. He's Donald Trump's guy. He hasn't lowered interest rates, or the Fed hasn't, the way the president wanted. Not that they've had that many opportunities. But I just appreciate the fact that we don't even talk about Kevin Warsh like we did his predecessor. And it just seems to be a more mature relationship between the two.
I think the independence is still there. I mean, the president's always going to nominate and appoint the Fed chair, confirmed through Congress. And I love the fact that the drama, it doesn't feel like a soap opera. And that's good for every investor who's listening right now.
One last thing about investors. There's another chip maker that is it an IPO that's coming up, or what's the price that they are selling at right now? Do you know the story I'm talking about, Craig?
Well, I mean, you must be referring to Sky Hynix, right?
Yeah.
Hynix.
Yeah.
I might be mispronouncing it, but again, this is why South Korea is on the map. It certainly turned out not to be for their soccer prowess at the World Cup. They bound out before the U.S. men's national team did, but we see how innovative DRAM and all of these semiconductors and chips are. And once again, we're in a place here where people are paying attention to IPOs. It wasn't just SpaceX. You got SK Hynix, you know, having an IPO at $149. And this too is going to be big, and it's oversubscribed because there's insatiable demand for chips because of the AI boom and enthusiasm.
What's the value of the Elon Musk stock right now? It opened at 117, 130, something like that. It was up to 176. I haven't looked at it for a while. Have you?
Yeah, well, I'm going to throw it up on the computer screen right now. So we're holding at $148 a share. And everybody remembers that IPO coming into the market. I think the IPO was at 135. We shot all the way up to 211. And here we are several weeks later at 148. And what I was most happy about, John, is what you and I talked about on that fateful Friday when the IPO happened. I'm happy the price only escalated to 211. I was worried it could be literally 50% or more than that, which could have injured an awful lot of investors. So this is proof, once again, that we have to be mindful, and whether it's buying an IPO or buying any great company of the globe, we want to do things with wide scale. Buy some now, buy some later, do your homework, because I'm not saying this is going to happen, but remember, once the lockup period ends, there's going to be a lot more liquidity in SpaceX, and it could temporarily trade back below its IPO price.
Well, is SpaceX part of the index funds? I know there was a lot of concern about that. Has it been included in them yet?
Everybody who owns the NASDAQ 100, everybody who owns broad-based indices is going to own SpaceX synthetically as it gets included in all of the index-based investments, because those are capitalization, cap-weighted investments. So everyone's going to have that synthetic exposure. And as you said, some clients chose, or some investors chose, to have direct exposure.
Yeah, and I don't think, though, it has been. It was like a 90-day window, I think, before it was going to be included, something like that. Does that ring a bell, Craig?
Yeah, that's correct. It's phased in for absolutely everybody, right? So, John, here is one time I'm going to say I don't know the absolute specifics, but I can tell people this. By the time we close out the quarter we're in, which is Q3, you're going to start seeing it reflected inside the holdings of the NASDAQ, the Russell Indices, the S&P Composite, et cetera. But, you know, the broad-based larger exposure isn't going to happen until those lockup periods expire, primarily 6 months after the IPO date, because at that point in time, there's going to be enough free float in SpaceX, which is at least 10% of the total shares, not 5%, to get everybody the access that they need.
Good to know. Craig Bolanos is the founder and wealth advisor at VestGen Wealth Partners. GetRetiredStayRetired.com is his website. Craig, thanks. Nice to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you and your audience as always, John.
Matt Schultz joins us, Chief Consumer Financial Analyst at LendingTree.com. The latest report or survey shows what, Matt? What did you guys look at this time?
Well, we looked at general optimism amongst businesses, and what we found was pretty good news. Most businesses are more likely to be optimistic about their performance, their demand, and even employment changes over the next 6 months than they were a year ago. Most businesses feel like things are going to be stable, but those who think there's going to be an appreciable change are much more likely to be optimistic than not, and that's good.
You broke it down by states, too, didn't you?
Yeah, what we found was that that in Illinois, y'all are kind of in the roughly middle of the pack, about the national average, but a lot of your neighbors are among the most optimistic businesses. Montana is the most, but your neighbors in Missouri and Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota are all among that list, too.
Yeah, I wonder what I would extrapolate from that. I mean, the numbers, they don't look like they're that far off one from the other. But I think the thing right. that plagues Illinois businesses is that the city of Chicago is not always seen as being especially business friendly. There's tax issues. There's politics. I guess that's everywhere. But I don't know if we consider Illinois to be sufficiently business friendly. Maybe that's part of it, would you say?
It certainly could be part of it, but I also think that some of it is just how big the state is in terms of business. And like we saw, California ranks pretty low on the list, Florida, New York. Most of the biggest states in the country ranked fairly low in terms of optimism. The exception to that was Texas, which ranked fairly high on the list.
Yeah, I think Texas will always be that way because it's Texas. But I suppose also a Montana, which is very high on the list, has nowhere to go but up. You know, I mean, business is pretty saturated in states like Texas, Florida, Illinois, California. Did you find certain sectors, you know, were people more optimistic in the manufacturing sector or healthcare? Did you break it down that way?
Yeah, we found that the most optimistic was actually utilities, which stands to reason because it's a necessity rather than a luxury. So it's a pretty good business to be in when things are uncertain. But yeah, healthcare was up at the top there, manufacturing, and then at the bottom was retail, which makes sense because that's where you kind of see customers struggle most quickly.
And I suppose AI is fueling some of that enthusiasm, right, in manufacturing and utilities, things like that.
I would think so. And then some of it is also just businesses getting a little more comfortable in all of the uncertainty that we've been in the last year and a half and maybe feeling like they're a little bit more able to manage that sort of experience.
Yeah, we've noticed that. It's a nice point that you make. Matt Schultz, Chief Consumer Financial Analyst over at LendingTree. You can read more about this at LendingTree.com. That's it for today, Matt, but thanks for your time. Thanks for the report. That's Matt Schultz from LendingTree.